Lord, take me where you want me to go. Let me meet who you want me to meet. Tell me what you want me to say, and keep me out of your way. I'm Dale, and I'm an alcoholic. And I guess y'all can tell I'm not from this neck of the woods. And you know, it's an honor, let me tell you, to do this deal. Through my job, I get to travel quite a bit, and I'm asked to share. I've been able to share all over the world and all around the United States. But I had a guy, Martin, from Den Haag, that told me, he says, "You haven't spoke anywhere until you spoke at this convention." So I appreciate the king for inviting me. And thank Holly for bringing us here, and Debbie for telling me that I've destroyed her language. And all the people that's here, you know. I like to look around whenever I share behind the podium. And it's always an honor to stand at the behind the podium, not enter a plea. You know, I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like. Step one, I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. What happened? Step three, I made a decision and acted on that decision to turn my will and my life over to care of God as I understood Him. And what it's like today. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of working these 12 spiritual principles, I have a story to share. There was these couple of drunks. They lived up under a bridge, and they went out and collected a bunch of bottles and cans. And first of all, let me tell you, I don't wear this suit to impress you. I wear it out of respect for the program Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor told me, anytime you stand behind a podium for Alcoholics Anonymous, you suit up and you show up. And that's what I do today, you know. You won't see me coming on in a pair of shorts holding my pants up. There was these couple of drunks. They went out and collected a bunch of bottles and cans, and they went and sold them, you know, and bought them a couple of bottle wines. They lived up under a bridge, and they drank them and passed out, like we always do. And they come to the next morning, and one of them turns to his buddy. He said, "Oh, I had the most fantastic dream." He said, "Well, what'd you dream about?" He said, "Oh, I dreamed I was living at home with my mom, and everything was wonderful and all this, and I had all this bottles of whiskey," and, you know, knock comes on the door, and here comes two beautiful women, and they start taking off the clothes. And his buddy, he's caught up in this story by now, and he says, "Oh, no." He said, "How come you didn't call me?" And his other buddy said, "Oh, I had one better than that, you know." He said, "Well, I dreamed I was living at home with my mom, and she gave me $20, and I went to Disney World, and I rode all the rides and met Mickey Mouse and all that, and I had the most fantastic time." And his other buddy told him that story. He said, "Well, yeah, you know, I had these beautiful women taking off the clothes." And the guy said, "Well, how come you didn't call me?" He said, "Well, I tried to, but your mom said you was at Disney World." And you see, that's my story right there. See, my family gave me everything that they thought that I needed, but I always wanted your dreams. I always wanted something else. I was born a long time ago in Miami, Florida. My father was a construction worker. That's the reason I was born down there. I know that my parents married at a very early age. That's the reason they decided to get a divorce. There were three children involved, and neither parent could afford living with us children separate like that. So me and my two brothers were sent to live in an orphanage for a while. I was probably 2 or 3 years old at the time, and that's where I got that fear of abandonment. What's going on? What's wrong with me? You know, and I didn't know whether I wasn't loved or whatever. But you know, I learned at a very early age that I could do whatever, I'd do anything for you to love me. I'd lie for you, I'd steal, I'd do anything. Eventually, my mom remarried and my stepfather came and adopted me and my two brothers out, so we were back together as a family. Eventually, my parents had two more children. There was five of us children in all, and we moved to a place in Alabama out in the country. And you know, my family's been there ever since, and my wife and I inherited the land, and we built a beautiful home there, and that's where we live today. But I had that fear, you know, when we come out of that orphanage. I can remember my first day at kindergarten. You know, I mean, in kindergarten, I'd get out, you know, I'd everybody say, "Oh, here comes Dale. He's got the latest comic books." You know, so I'd go in these drugstores and all, and I'd steal all the latest comic books. Now I'm 3 or 4 years old at the time, and I'm sticking these comics down my pants, pulling my shirt out. So I'm buying friendship at this very early age. Now, after I'm adopted, me and my family, when we moved to this new school, and so I shrunk back to that shy kid in an orphanage. But I went out on the playground that day, and there was a bunch of boys out there fighting. I said, "Oh, this is going to be a fun school." So I jump in there with them. They haul us all up to the office. The principal asked who started. They pointed to me, the newcomer. I got my butt whooped, but I got accepted. And I've been doing that all my life until I come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Eventually, my parents saw that there was a lot of money in alcohol, so my family went into the bar business. My stepfather didn't drink. My mom didn't drink. So that's where I saw all you drunks. I wasn't going to be like y'all. I used to clean up that bar on Saturday morning and Sunday morning, the smell of puke, the smell of urine. I wasn't going to be like you. And there was this one guy there. He was a quiet drunk. He'd just sit at the bar. He'd pass out, drink, pass out, drink. And then eventually he disappeared, and I never know what happened to him until I come to the room of Alcoholics Anonymous and found out where he went and how all the people he'd helped, and he became my first sponsor. So I wasn't going to be like you drunks, you know. But, you know, me and my brothers, we were raised in that bar. So we learned how to, we played pool and all this stuff. And eventually, you know, I went on growing up, I wasn't going to be a drunk, wasn't going to drink. But I got into the drug scene because, you know, that wasn't you alcoholics. And I finally got out of high school. My brother was in IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. So he got me in the Electricians Union. And I was working at a nuclear power plant in Dothan, Alabama at the time. Now, I automatically shrunk back to that shy kid in an orphanage because I was around all these new people, didn't know what to do. But what we'd do, I'd go to work, I'd go to school twice a week, and then we'd go home. But there was a bar we used to stop down there in Dothan. My brother, I didn't consider him an alcoholic at the time, but now I've changed my mind. But and my brother, we'd drink. My brother drank a couple of beers. We'd shoot pool, and I'd get a Coca-Cola, and then, you know, we'd go home. Well, it was a hot day. If you know where Dothan, Alabama is, down on real on the Florida line, it's hot. It's if you can figure it out, it's about 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It's real hot down there. And so that's back in, you know, the early 70s. So I'm an electrician apprentice. I'm in a ditch about 5 foot wide, 5 foot deep, 5 miles long. And I'm digging. And when I crawl out of there, I'm dirty, I'm nasty, and I'm thirsty. And we pulled in that bar, and they just sold their last coat. And that's when I picked up that beer for the first time. And I didn't like the taste, but I automatically liked the effect. I done found a new coping skill, and it was in alcohol. From the first time that I picked that up and drank it, I was it. You know, you talked about that crossing the bridge. Heck, there I was there. I was already on the other side. So I started drinking alcoholically at that moment on. And when I first started drinking, I wasn't the maintenance drinker that I eventually became. I was a weaver. I was just weaving all over this construction site. And all these big union officials were saying, "Well, what are we going to do with this guy? Because he used to be a good worker. He'd go to school like that." Well, we can't get rid of him because his brother's pretty big in the union. We'll just transfer him. So they transferred me back to Montgomery, where my parents were, and on another project. So I moved back home with my parents. And, you know, so here, the alcohol is still going on. Now, my parents still run the bar, and so I moved back in. Over the years, my parents made a lot of money off us alcoholics, so I built them a beautiful home on the hill, had it on the bar a couple of times. So I moved back home with my parents, and, you know, that was my castle. From the sun deck of the house, you could hear the band playing on Friday and Saturday night. So we were partying at the house. So when the music quit up at the bar, it was time for the party to quit at the house. We were drinking, we were drugging, we were doing what guys and girls do, and eventually I got a girl pregnant. And I thought, you know, maybe if I get married, you know, We're some smart thinkers, drinking and thinking. drinking and thinking. Maybe if I get married, you know, I'll settle down. And I did for a while, but you see, I done had these coping skills. I had to see and be seen. I tell my wife, well, I need to go get a beer or so. And I'd be gone 2 or 3 days. And that was never my intention. Never. You know, but when I picked up the first drink, took the first drink, everything went out the window. And my wife, 2 or 3 days later, she'd come and she'd find me in a bar and she said, Dale, you ready to come home? And I said, yeah, I'll be there in a minute. And she'd sit right there until I got ready to go, because if she was to leave, there's no telling when she'd see me again. Now, I keep getting laid off and transferred with the union, and laid off and transferred. So, you know, I had, all during my drinking career, I had sparks of sanity. Today I call them sparks of insanity. Because, but I said, why should I keep paying these union dues if they keep transferring me or laying me off? I know what I'll do. I'll just quit the union. I'll quit the union and save them thousands of dollars. I bet they had a big old party when Dale quit the union. But I went to work at that time, the biggest non-union construction company in the world, Brown & Root. And Brown & Root worked a lot of cost-plus jobs where it didn't matter what the project was, I was going to get paid. And by then, I was a maintenance drinker, you know. I just drank all the time. And I worked up through the ranks of Brown & Root. You know, us Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a perfectionist still today, you know. Perfect is close enough. But I just, you know, I'm a perfectionist, but I would just, we're not dumb people, we just do dumb things. And so I, you know, I worked up through the ranks. I think we're hardworking. When will you can get us to work? So I worked up through the ranks, you know, and I became a supervisor of Brown & Root. And I traveled a lot with them. And I used to work so I was transferred to a Chevron oil refinery down in Pascagoula, Mississippi, on the Gulf Coast of the United States. And whenever I get used to in between union jobs with or when I'm transferred, I used to work with with Peace Concerts out of Macon, Georgia, and I used to work at Capricorn Records. And what I used to do is I used to do the electrical hookup for a lot of big concerts. I traveled with the Stones, I traveled with the Who, you know, I'd hook up all their equipment for them. So I always partied with bands, you know. I mean, I liked the way they party. So whenever I moved to a new city or something, I always went to the bars and hooked up with the band. Now, and I always had some real high-class bars. You know how it is. We start off at these real nice nightclubs, and then we get to what I call them alligator bars, where you can crawl in on your belly, look good as anybody. But my last 3 bars, I had some real nice place. One of them was called The Dungeon. It had bars on the window, and the windows painted black. I really liked that until I started going to jail. And then they had Nasty Feet's. Nasty Feet's was a biker bar where you could ride in the bar on your motorcycle, you know. They're having sex in this booth, you know, smoking up in there. Oh, a real nice place. And the one down here in Pascagoula was called Possum Hollow. You know, so that tells you what a nice place it was. And I always got hooked up with a band, and I got to be best friends with a bass player. His name was Smokey. Now, I don't know if Smokey was alcoholic or not, but I think he was, because he had a lot of our tendencies. His wife had done left him, she was divorced, and she done took all his furniture and all his stuff, like his car. So he said, Dale, he said, you reckon you can get me a job with Brown & Root? Oh, no problem. So I loaned him one of my cars, because I'd worked overseas a couple of times, so I had a little bit of stuff. My wife, she collected antiques, so we had plenty of furniture. So I loaned him some furniture, loaned him a car, got him a job, and you know how we're thinking now. Well, this course ain't all that bad. What we ought to do when it becomes final is have a divorce party. Now, my middle name by this time is Party. I don't care what it's Halloween party, funeral party, or divorce party. I'm always ready to go. So Smokey has his divorce party over at his house. He's got everybody from Brown & Root, everybody from Possum Hollow. And he's got a refrigerator full of any kind of beer you want, all the liquor over here you want, and in the back room, anything you want to smoke, snort, or shoot, because not everybody did it. And I'm doing what I always do. I'm getting drunk. And he had these two Altec Voice of the Theater speakers. Now, if you don't know what those are, those each one of them's twice as big as this podium. It's what back in the 70s, all the big concert the bands used to use those. I mean, beautiful speakers. And he had them cranked up, and they sounded good. And my buddy, he's over to me. And he said, "Dale, I sure would like to marry your wife." And I said, "Smokey, I sure do like your speakers." Two weeks later, I come home. Smokey's sitting on my couch with my wife. She wants to divorce me and marry Smokey. I said, "That's fine. I want those speakers." So Smokey got my wife and kids, and I got those two Altec Voice of the Theater speakers. I let them keep the cars in case my kids had to go to the doctor's. I'm letting them keep the furniture. But my wife said, I don't want child support. I don't want anything. You know, just all I want is my freedom. But I knew eventually I'd get a knock on the door. Sheriff's department back child support. So I went ahead and I made some money over in Saudi Arabia. So I went ahead and paid my child support for my two boys up front. One of the biggest mistakes I ever done in my life. Because my wife eventually, she disappeared with my two children. And I started coming home to an empty house. It wasn't empty. You know, it had my boys' pictures on the walls, the beds, the toys on the floor. Poor me. Poor me. Pour me another drink. I started seeing all these, you know, no sounds of my children. Pour me, pour me, pour me another drink. And I started drinking around that stuff. And I started missing time at work. And my boss, he came over to my house. He said, "Dale, I know you're going through some trying times with this divorce. You coming home and spend the night with me. We're going to go out to the bar and drink a little bit. And then you coming home and I'm going to take you to work." Now, he knew how much I drank. He was one of my drinking buddies. He told me one time, he said, "You're going to come on this job sober one day, and I might like it." So we went, we ate, went to the bar, and that next morning, he didn't let me go out to get my breakfast. Now, by this time, alcohol had become such an obsession, it was like the air I had to breathe. And without it, I'd die. By 9 o'clock, I'd have the shakes. I worked 20 stories up in the air on steel, and I'd shake off the steel if I didn't have the alcohol. So he sent me out to get something to drink. Eventually, I missed more time at work, and eventually my crew come out and said, "Dale, we had to fire you." But they were such a good enabling company, they said, "Well, we're going to fix it where you can draw your unemployment," which was $105 a week, state of Mississippi unemployment, "and whenever you want your job back, you can come back out here and get your job with the same rate." Now, I had retirement savings for Brown Root. I had a little bit of Saudi Arabia money left over after paying that child support. And I was going to draw $105 a week, state of Mississippi unemployment. Who the hell needs a job? So I start drinking through that. And I'd go to the bars, and I'd buy y'all all drinks and tell you how sorry my wife was, how sorry my best friend was, but wasn't telling you how sorry I was. And you'd listen, you know, as long as I'm buying them drinks. And I found out later, you know, I become a good listener like that. And I started, you know how it is when you're drinking like this, and I'm going out to these bars, you know, and I'm getting a lot of mail. You know, you get a lot of mail when you're alcoholic. You know, light bills, rent, eviction notices. Don't they know what I'm going through? I just rake them in the trash can. Eventually, I come home one night from a bar, and there's 10 pickup trucks in my yard, my landlord, and the police. And the police took me for a ride. And what my landlord and all her friends in Kate, they threw out in the yard and my neighbors got. So I didn't have my wife, my children, none of those possessions that I cherish so much. But I had this Cadillac, big wheel, drive back and forth that Brown Root job. So the insanity of my disease was I'd drive out to this place where I used to drive around to these different bars and park in front of this house I used to live in. Pour me, pour me, pour me another drink. Eventually, my landlady, she got tired of that, so I get a knock on my window, car window, and it's the cops. They locked me up and found my car. The next day, they say, "Well, we can't get you for trespassing because you wasn't on the property, but it's going to cost you $100 to get your car out of impound." Now, by this time, I'd done drank through that retirement savings, the rest of that Saudi money, and the only thing I had to drink on was $105 a week, state of Mississippi unemployment. Now, what good is that car to me if I'm dead? To drink, not drink, is to die. So I let my car go. And I wound up there. Now, there's a... This came to me in a blackout when we were saying our closing prayer. And in the States, we close with the Lord's Prayer at a lot of meetings. But this came... A lot of that was blackout drinking. And during this time, I used to go to the soup kitchen with the rest of the drunks, the winos, the unfortunates. And you could buy a quart of beer for 99 cents, and I'd drink that and go get in whatever it was they were serving, and I'd eat it, and my stomach wasn't used to the food, so I'd go back behind it, throw it up, and then I lived in a 25-inch color television box at the time. Not one of them flat screens. And I had it duct taped up so I wouldn't kick the sides out when I had my nightmares. And I lived in a hobo jungle, and I lived like that for I don't know how long. But this came to me when we, and I forgot all about this place, but the name of the place was Our Daily Bread. And we said that one day in a meeting, and it just came back to me. And I've had the privilege of making amends to that thing for saving my life. Eventually, my mom and sister heard there was a crazy person living behind a store in Pascagoula, Mississippi, so they come to rescue me. They found me, they said, "Hey, Dale, we think you got a problem." "Oh, I'm just fine. Just camping out." You can imagine what it looked like. I didn't have a razor, didn't have one set of clothes, you know, didn't have a toothbrush. So I was looking fine. Just camping out. "Fine, you don't even have a job." "Yeah, I do." "Well, prove it to us." They take me out to the Brown Root job. The guard said, "Hey, Dale, how you doing?" I said, "Fine." My sister turns to my mom and says, "Well, heck, he must have a job." So they come back to Alabama. I went back to my store. And I lived like that until I run out of unemployment, run out of friends, run out of enemies, and I had a spark of sanity. "If you don't go home, you'll die." So I went back home to Alabama to live with my parents. Now, my stepfather's deceased at this time. My mom still runs the bar. And I don't know where she got this, but she thinks I got a problem with alcohol. So I'm barred from the family bar. I can't go in there and have a couple of drinks when I want to. So, but my brother bartends up there, so it's okay for me to go in there when my mom's not around and get whatever it is I want to drink, because he's keeping on a ticket because somebody's going to come in there and I'm going to hustle them on the pool table or something like that, or watch for when they drop their wallet or something. But I never could understand this. The whole time I'm doing that, my brother's up here by the cash register like this. So I built a resentment against my mother. How dare her? I built her that beautiful home. I've added on this bar a couple of times. She won't let me come and have a couple of drinks every once in a while. So I fixed it, me a little trap door where I could go in there and drink like Dale likes to drink when they close up. Now she said, "Dale, you got to get a job. You can't live here without a job." Now I've got 5 journeyman tickets. I'm a journeyman electrician, carpenter, iron worker, rod buster, millwright. I can go on any construction job in the world and get a job. But at this time, you know, I'm a philosopher. I got to go get a job, you know, serve my fellow man. So I get me a job bartending. Now my boss says, "Dale, I can't pay you but minimum wage, but it's okay for you to get you a beer every once in a while." So every day I'm giving myself a raise because I'm going deeper and deeper in that cooler. And, you know, I have another spark of sanity. You know, if you get locked up in this bar at night, you can drink all night and it won't cause you sanity. So my boss, he has to go back in the back, cut the lights off, and I go hide in this bar. And he locks me in. Pretty nice. So I drink, pass out, drink, pass out, drink, pass out. So in the morning, he has to go in the back, cut the lights on, I shoot out the front door. 2 minutes later, I'm his first customer. He said, "Dang, I'm Dale, you must need a drink." I said, "I do." And the fear of that man not serving me, I'd have the shakes. I would need a drink. Now, like I said, my parents' bar is a private club. It's open on Sundays, closed one night a week, and that was on Tuesday nights. So I'd go in there, my little trap door, and I'd drink, pass out, drink, pass out, and then go in. One day I was passed out in my parents' bar, and I hear a noise, and I roll over, and I'm looking at a flashlight and a .357 Magnum. And it's my little brother. He left something up in there and heard me rolling around there and thought I was a burglar and liked to shot me. And that's when I set up on that cot that I always passed out on and said, yeah, I think I've got a problem. And that was in 1986. Now, they tell you in Texas that if you don't state your sobriety date, you probably don't have one. So my sobriety date is September 8, 1988. So for you newcomers, it took me 12 years in and out of the program Alcoholics Anonymous to get that. So that was in and out, in and out, in and out. And I told my sponsor one time, I said, you know, my program's not working. He says, yours never will. You need to stop and work our program. So ever since I stopped and worked your program, I've got sober. So thank y'all for letting me use your program. So I saw that, I went into treatment in 86, you know, I saw all these people in there, you know, I've got a half a brain here, you know, I do these 12 steps, so I memorized all that stuff. I was Mr. AA. I had all answers, didn't nobody have me, hadn't asked me no questions. I wrote a book, as Dale sees it. Now, if y'all had read this book and followed it, this would be an empty room tonight. But, and I went to meetings, and I stayed on a dry drunk for a year and a half. I wasn't drinking, but I was going crazy. You know, the reason we have the suicide rates in this program is because we have the defects of character, and that's what the 12 steps does. It does on the recognition of the defects of character and clearing up the wreckage of our past. But you see, here I wasn't working the 12 steps. I wasn't drinking, I wasn't drugging, but I still the same SOB, sorry person I was before. So, you know, I was going crazy. And eventually, after a year and a half, somebody offered me some cocaine on the job. Cocaine wasn't my drug of choice. But anytime you swap alcohol for drugs or drugs for alcohol, you're swapping seats on the Titanic. It leads you back to your drug of choice, and immediately I picked up the alcohol and started drinking. And my last drunk lasted 6 months. It's all blackout. Don't remember much about it. I do remember I had some good witnesses. Now, I was in a bar one night on a Sunday night. Now, I used to work a lot of shutdowns. A shutdown is where you work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, months at a time, make $1,000, $2,000 a week. Somebody'd say, hey, Dale, let's go work a shutdown over here. Let's go work a shutdown over there. I said, well, I need to finish out this week and get my paycheck and then go. They said, man, you're going to make this money. We'll loan you some money. Don't worry about it. So I left money all over the United States. So I was in a bar on a Sunday night. And I saw this old guy I used to work with. I said, well, hey, John. I said, who are you working with? He says, I'm working with the same people we were, and I'm drinking and thinking. I said, those SOBs owe me $300. Yeah, they owe me $300 because I walked off a job, and they didn't know where to send the money to. And he said the magic words you didn't tell alcoholic of my caliber. You'll never get it. I'm drinking and thinking. Now, I could have went to the job site the next morning, gave my Social Security number, they wrote me a check for $300, no problem. I went to the job site that night. Cut the locks on six of the trailers, had all the tools outside piled up, pouring gas on, alarms going off, ding, 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 ding. The cops get there and they said, he's crazy, ding, 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 and I was. You know, you when you're drinking, you're 6 foot tall, bulletproof, invisible. They took me to the hospital because I was pronounced legally dead, overdose, alcohol, and cocaine. They kept me there to where my blood level was where I was alive again, and they threw me in the county jail. And that's where I really like to die, the DTs, the hallucination, the dry heaves. I laid on that cold concrete floor for about 3 days in a fetal position because I couldn't straighten up because I done puked all my guts out. And this person come up to me on the third day, he said, you sick, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, well, I got some medicine for you. He had a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I done seen what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for you people. And I said, you know, if I was going to work my life, change my life and work this program, I was going to have to start. And that's when I started this program, September 8, 1988. I was sentenced to a split sentence, two in prison, three on paper, and substance abuse treatment at the state nut house. I waited for our opening at that state facility for 9 months. Me and that man had an AA meeting every day. I went to that treatment facility, you know, and I had all these doctors telling me, I was sick as hell, psychiatrists telling me I was crazy as hell, and preachers telling me I was going to hell. But there was a nut out. If he's alive, he's still there because he was a nut. But he came up to me one day, he said, you know, if you don't drink, you ain't got to be here. Now, tell me God don't talk to people. So I got out after 30 days, and I hear a lot of people talking about bottoms. I don't believe in bottoms. If your bottom brought you in that door over there, you go out there and drink and drug again, you're going to find out your bottom's got a basement. It gets worse. I promise you that. But I met people at that facility that reached their bottoms on this earth. They got a room that's got these tables in it, and they got men and women laid on being fed intravenously. We'll never leave that room. Alcohol and drug overdose. Same thing I was doing out there taking care of business. They got another group of people, I call them the football team, because they got helmets on their head, and they got the hands strapped to the side and being led around by ropes because they're beating themselves all up against the wall. Alcohol and drug overdose. Same thing I was doing out there to take care of business. See, I'm not supposed to be here tonight. It's only through a loving God, sponsorship, and you people working the program Alcoholics Anonymous. So eventually I got out of that, headed back to the county jail, had to go back before the judge. My lawyer come up to me and says, Dale, they said you did such a good time up at Bryce's Hospital, they're going to let you do the rest of the time on paper. God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. That's what I said. See, I have a God who understands, Dale, and know if I got released then, I'd be dead. I'd be on one of them slabs, or I'd be on that football team. 2 days before they were supposed to let me out, they brought 5 more charges against me. Things that happened when I was working a shutdown over here, something over there. So I told my lawyer, I said, well, check my trailer and, get my check stubs to show I was working out of town here when this thing happened. Your house has been cleared out ever since you've been locked up. Well, get my girlfriend, she can tell you. They've been looking for her ever since you've been locked up. They said, the DA is going to work a deal with you. Plead guilty, and he'll drop all 4 charges at one and let it run concurrent to what you're doing now, and you fix and go to house. Well, what if he doesn't? Well, the worst you can get is 10 years. I went for that judge, he hammers that gavel down and said, 10 years. You see, that's what I had to grasp the program Alcoholics Anonymous, the humility we talk about this program, to be called that number, that 153808, instead to wear those dirty whites and go into that penitentiary. But let me tell you, I was freer in prison than most of my friends were on the streets through the program Alcoholics Anonymous. We had AA 3 nights a week, 12 and 12, 3 nights a week, NA, and I went to meetings. I just floated down that hall. You know, and that's because of you people. And you know, you go to prison in the state of Alabama, you don't just sit around, you got to do something. You got to get a job, or you got to work, you got to do something. So now, I got half a brain here, and my company would send me to various colleges. As long as I kept my grades up, you know, they'd pay for it. So I've got a half a brain up here. So my job while I was in penitentiary was I taught the GED, which is helping inmates get their high school equivalency. And I was able to do that, and then, you know... See, I never thought I could help anybody else, but they showed me I could. Eventually, they sent some people down to the prison to teach us tutors, law block, teaching illiterate how to read and write. And I had the privilege of teaching men how to read these 12 steps and all that. And I went into a corrections field, and I go to these meetings all over the U.S., and I hear somebody in one of these prisons that I taught to read these promises. The gratitude I get out of that is unbelievable. I was there in that penitentiary probably for a year. Eventually they come and tell me, said, Dale, you're eligible for this program. You're going to get out. So, SIR program. So I was able to get out. And I had to move in with a sponsor, a family member, and it was my mom. Now my mom knew that I was a crazy person. There's no telling where what I'd do or whatever, but she accepted me. That first week, I'd arrange where I could go to meetings. She'd say, I'd go to meetings every night. She said, Dale, do you need to go to those meetings every night? I said, do you want the same person here that was here before? And after a couple of weeks, she saw how you people had changed me. She'd be looking out, don't you have a meeting to go to? My mother, for 18 years of my sobriety, she'd get up there and she'd thank Alcoholics Anonymous for giving her son back. You know, I was, out of us five children, the last years of her life, if she had a problem, she'd turn to me. And that's something, a gift that you gave me. I got out of the penitentiary and I was out probably about 2 or 3 months. This lady said, are you ready to go back to prison? I said, no, ma'am. She said, well, I want you to go back into prison and share your experience drinking hope. I said, well, the state of Alabama won't let you go back in until you've been out for 2 years. She said, well, when did God go on vacation, leave them in charge? She said, I've already got you cleared. So I wound up going into the women's prison and sharing my experience drinking hope. And I wound up working there for 3 years, working with the WINGS program, Women Incarcerated Now Getting Straight. And not sharing with them how I got out of prison, but how I stay out working a program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to meetings, And then, you know, they come up to me. Now, when you get a 10-year prison system sentence in the state of Alabama, you can't, you don't get good time. So my parole date would have been 10 years. But they said, Dale, you're working in prison when you're on parole. We can't have that. So they granted, the first time in the state of Alabama, they granted me early parole. And 3 months after that, they called me in and they said, Dale, you know those five crimes you pled guilty to? We got a guy here who said he did it. And I've had the privilege of meeting that man behind the prison walls, and he's working a program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the gratitude, for me not just going and serving that little bit of time is what makes me stand up here today. When I got out, I started going back into the penitentiaries. I was treatment facilities chairman for Area 1, which is Alabama, Northwest Florida. Then where I was legal, where I could go into all the prisons, 2 years later, I went into the corrections, and that's what I've done for a long time. In 95, I was offered the opportunity to go back overseas and work. And I met my wife in 94, and we got engaged, and then I left her. And I went to work in the Marshall Islands. Now, the Marshall Islands is in between Hawaii and Australia, right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And the Marshallese people, they look up to the Americans because we rescued them during World War II. And they, you know, they'd say, oh, the Americans, Americans. So they'd immunate us. And these little kids, they'd be coming and pulling my pants legs and say, see, see. And they'd pull the lip down and they'd have tobacco there because they saw the Americans do it. And the king of the Marshallese, he keeps the people real humble. You know, it costs a lot for them to drink. But the American counterparts, you know, they'd be buying them alcohol. Now, there's three things you can do in the Marshall Islands. You can play golf, you can drink, or you can go to the best scuba dive in the world. So I got my advanced open water, I got my rescue diver, and then I got my dive master there. But these people, you know, these little Marshallese women, they'd come 2 weeks every time they got paid every 2 weeks. And they'd come for their husbands to go get the groceries, but their husbands were gone and off spending the money. And they're real proud people. And you go to the jail over in the Marshall Islands, they don't take your belt and shoestring so you don't commit. They take all your clothes. So these guys, they're so proud, they find out how they mistreated their wives and their children. They were committing suicide. They were down like flies in these jails over there. So the king of the Marshall Islands came into our little AA group over there and asked if we'd come in there and take a meeting. And, you know, I've done corrections meetings, so we said, yeah. So me and three other guys, excuse me, we go into this room. There's about 30 naked men. And we call that group the Bare Facts Group. And we told these people that there were, you know, that we've done a lot of things that we're ashamed of, but we have a way out. And these 12 spiritual principles, these 12 steps, these traditions, this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, and hopefully that means going on today. I've been able to come back and we got married, and we wound up going to Istanbul in 2000, and we were supposed to come home for vacation. And the State Department called me up and said, well, we need you here for a meeting, so you're going to have to change your vacation. So I told Christine to go on home. And so she flew back to the States, and she called me up a couple of days later. She said, Dale, I just got a call from your youngest son. They had been looking for me for all these years, and I'd been looking for them. And so when I came home, we were able to meet up with my two sons that I hadn't seen in 18 years. Now, that little woman that told me, that took me into those prisons, she said, Dale, she said, you'll get those children back on God's time. You just keep doing what you're doing. And that's the way the program Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, I love the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a co-worker ask me the other day, he said, Dale, you got 25 years sobriety. Why do you keep going to meetings? Let me tell you. I go to meetings for the newcomer, so you can tell me, or the person that keeps coming back, that tells me that alcohol is still out there and it's not working. You know, the monkey might be off my back, but the circus is still in town. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous because I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. You take away the alcohol, I still have the ism. I, self, and me. And you people get me out of that. I go to Alcoholics Anonymous because where can a person from Alabama meet all you people like this? You know, all the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous that's mentioned after the ninth step have come true in my life. Every one of them. But the biggest promise has come through working the 12 spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Is though Alcoholics Anonymous might not open the gates of heaven and let me in, but it has opened the gates of hell and let me out. Thank you.